Welcome back, everybody, to the Get Fit podcast series. I am your host, Andy Gallardo, coming to you from beautiful Pasadena, California, on a bright and sunny December day. And it is a beautiful day, but I do feel like I need to mention we are in the middle of a giant wildfire season in Southern California. And our thoughts and prayers are definitely with those affected by the blaze, and definitely with all of the thousands of men and women who are fighting this fire. You are in our thoughts, and we are keeping our fingers crossed that this ends soon. Now, on a better note, I am super excited to share with you a segment titled Family Tragedy and Getting Back to Basics. It's the little things that matter. And here today, sharing his story, is Dr. Adam Sharp, an emergency physician and research scientist for the Southern California Permanente Medical Group. In addition to being just a really good guy, Adam is a former member of the University of Utah's Final Four basketball team. How cool is that? Adam is a research scientist, meaning he identifies gaps in the healthcare delivery system and evaluates ways to improve it. I first heard Adam speak at a KP TEDx event, and right away I knew I wanted him on the podcast. Now, a bit of a warning here, you may need some tissues for this episode, but it's a good one. A couple of quick disclaimers. This information is not intended to replace your healthcare professional. Opinions of hosts and guests do not represent the views or opinions of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, or Southern California Permanente Medical Group. None of these entities receive any compensation for products or services mentioned on the show, nor do they endorse or promote any products mentioned. The full disclaimer can be found on our website. Enjoy the show. All right, Dr. Adam Sharp, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, what I normally do with all of our wonderful physicians is the first question I always ask is, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. And then more importantly, tell us about, like, did you always want to be a doctor, or when did you know, or how did that happen in your life?
Yeah, great question. I am not a typical Southern California person. I am just really ecstatic to be here now that I've arrived. But I grew up near Salt Lake City, a suburb outside of there. I was the oldest of five kids, and I cared mostly about sports growing up. Really any team sport, basketball, baseball, football. When it got to be high school time, I focused on basketball, and that was kind of what I spent my time doing. And so I always told people I wanted to be a doctor. I think my mom kind of may have brainwashed me as a young child that that was what she wanted me to be. I still have on my wall a picture that I drew as part of the reflections program. I wasn't terribly creative as a kid, so it was I Have a Dream, the Martin Luther King theme. And so I drew a picture of me sleeping in bed with, you know, the dream dots going up, and that was of me being a doctor. So, I mean, at least in first grade, I had that thought. But I think as with any of us, when we choose our profession, I remember in college doing some soul searching and thinking, is this really what I want to do? Or is it was interesting because becoming a physician, my best friend's dad was a doctor, and he was the closest thing I had to someone to bounce ideas off. And so I remember when I told him, hey, you know, Grant, I think I want to be a physician and go into medicine. And he's like, don't do it. Don't do it. And really most, it was sad. Most of the docs that I talked to saw the golden ages of medicine had passed, and they really tried to discourage me. So I, at that point, I had to do a lot of, you know, evaluating. I was a business major in college, not because I didn't plan to go to medical school, but because my wife had worked in the business side of medicine. And she's like, these docs don't really know anything about how to run their practice outside of medicine. So there was a period where I was kind of figuring that out, and read an article that just kind of struck home. It wasn't about medicine. It was actually about a dentist. And I just felt like medicine was it. And so I've been really happy that that was the decision and the route that I went. So I'm very happy to be here, but it's a challenge for many.
And so how did the journey go from college into medicine, and how did you end up at Kaiser Permanente and Southern California Permanente Medical Group?
Well, very interesting question. I would guess my route is very different from most, if not all, of the Permanente physicians. As I mentioned, no one in my family was in the healthcare field. So once I decided medicine was it, I had intended to learn how to be a great doc and planned to go back home to probably southern Utah because I liked the warm weather and had family down there near Zion's National Park. And so it was a gradual process. So I played basketball in college and then got injured. And that was actually a blessing because it helped me get into medical school because I had more time to study.
Okay.
But I went to medical school at the University of Utah and loved it there. Went to undergrad in medical school, decided on emergency medicine and that was great. When I went to residency in the Midwest in Indianapolis. It was part of the Indiana University, and it was a great program because it had a community hospital, had a county hospital, and it was under an academic umbrella. I was a little bit indecisive, so I wasn't sure which of the three programs would be best for me. And as I was there, I realized that the same faculty members of IU emergency department practiced very different at the county hospital as they did at the community hospital. These hospitals were less than a mile apart. Very similar patient populations.
Interesting.
And that spurred my, you know, I was like, well, why are we doing things differently? Like, right. These are people I respect. That made me interested in research. And so I started talking to people and became more interested in, I thought, well, if research is an objective way to evaluate if one's better than another and something that generalizes, I became interested in research. And so I applied to the Robert Johnson Clinical Scholars Program, which it has changed, but for a long time it was at four places, and the University of Michigan was one of them. So my last year of residency, I decided to apply for that. People who know they want to do it, you have to apply 2 years in advance. So this is a long story that I went from go be a good community doc, go back home to Utah to a research fellowship, which I never had intended. And then as part of the Robert Johnson Clinical Scholars Program, my issue is research is the research shows
right.
We don't apply it.
Right.
At all the academic medical centers, I went to 10 places. 9 of them were academic medical centers. And that's the route that researchers go. And when I was interviewing, I talked to people and I said, well, so when we find answers to these questions, how are we going to apply it in our health system? And there wasn't a one of them that could give me a thoughtful answer about how they applied the research that they did in their institution to the healthcare they were providing. And through random chance, I ran into a guy, Gabriel Escobar, who did the same fellowship as I did, and he's a Permanente doc up in Northern California. And he said, well, you got to look in Southern California. They have a unique program right now. They're looking for somebody to do applied research. And it was perfect timing, perfect fit. And when I got here, I thought, boy, this is what I want to do. They care more about the care delivery than they do the research. The research is kind of an extra bonus. And so that's what landed me here is I came originally to work 80% in the research evaluation department. Many don't even know we have a research evaluation department in Southern California. So I was really lucky. I still work at LA Medical Center in the emergency department, but I spend the majority of my time doing healthcare research and trying to do what I saw a problem with when I was in residency, which is why aren't we doing what the research shows, or why are we doing
right? What's the point of research if you're not going to apply it?
So that's been a great fit. I came here because it was a unique, you know, other than the VA, I don't know that there's any other health system that could do this other than Kaiser Permanente. We have, you know, the integrated health model allows us to do the right things for patients, which isn't unfortunately isn't always the case. Sometimes the incentives aren't aligned. So so that's what landed me. And our family of 6, because I married our 4 kids here in LA.
Okay.
So, but we've really loved to be here. Got here just over 4 years ago and really love it.
No, that's awesome. And I remember when I first saw you speak, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and they introduced you.
Yeah.
They introduced you as a research scientist. And I remember I was with another person. I remember looking over and going, we have those at Kaiser Permanente? You know, so that's a really interesting thing, and I'm glad that somebody's actually interested in taking what you find and doing something with it. So very cool. So not only did you find that path into medicine, but you found your path into emergency medicine. So I mean, most of us only know what we see on TV. You know, is the ER and the emergency department, is it really like what we see?
In some ways, yes. In many ways, no. I'm not as handsome as the doctors we see on TV for sure. But I can say my route to emergency medicine was a little bit circuitous. And I say that because I really enjoyed all my rotations as a medical student, which was nice. I enjoyed my OB rotation. I enjoyed my surgery rotation. I enjoyed internal medicine. I enjoyed family medicine. I enjoyed inpatient care. I thought I was better at, I think it aligned better with my strengths as kind of the acute care setting. So I kind of landed on, I wanted to do something in acute care, which could be broad. But in medical school, they wouldn't allow us to do an emergency medicine rotation until we'd finished our third year. And there was a community emergency medicine rotation we could take. It was the very last rotation in my third year, which they allowed me because I didn't have anything left in my third year. And I remember my very first shift, it was a night shift. It was like the 3 p.m. to midnight shift.
Oh, gosh.
And I went in and I loved it. I mean, in my mind, it was what medicine was. And I liked the fact that you didn't know what was behind door number two or door number three.
Right.
You had to be ready for everything. And it was a little terrifying. I mean, it still is. I still get butterflies when I'm going into the emergency department because you don't know.
Right.
You don't know who's coming in. Could be anything. All patients, all comers, and I liked that. I liked the thought that at least we had an organized way to try and help people. You know, my residency director always said we take care of people on the worst day of their life, and that really is true.
Right.
And I liked that. There's a downside because there's not continuity of care. So the patients you see and you make a connection with, there's certainly that aspect that's missed in primary care, and people that have more continuity certainly can take advantage of that. But it was a good fit, and I've been happy that's where I landed.
I'm going to make a weird connection here and tell me if I'm wrong. Do you think being an athlete and playing sports, has that really helped you in the emergency room, being part of a team, and in particular basketball's pretty fast, you know what I mean? I know that's probably a little bit of a stretch, but...
No, I'm an ex-dumb jock. There's no stretch for sports analogies with me. And the answer is absolutely yes. And I think, I don't know if it helps more in emergency medicine than any other version of medicine. What I loved about sports looking back and not currently being the active participant in competitive athletics, I enjoy coaching and helping my kids do it. I feel like the process of working together towards whether it be winning a game or whatever your end goal is certainly something that I still look back on with fondness. And, you know, part of that means there's the hard part of sports. Like, you know, for me, not the hard part, but the part you may like less, waking up in the morning to jump rope or do your ball handling drills or whatever it is you're doing to try and improve. You don't necessarily love doing that, but I think the process of doing your best to work hard to accomplish the goals, no question, is helpful. And I was really lucky in college. I played with some really amazing people, had an amazing coach who, you know, really helped me to see what it is to try to be the best at whatever it is that you do. And I think that process certainly is something I still try and reflect on and try to emulate, whether it's in the emergency department or doing research or doing whatever. I think the pattern that one follows, I think, to achieve success is certainly learned in athletics, and certainly something that I took away from that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's good to know, and it just seems like a logical connection. You know, the teamwork and the fast pace, and I always hear people referring to emergency physicians as kind of adrenaline junkies, but I think it's just more that they've kind of maybe come from something in their background that makes them.
Well, I think, you know, it certainly was helpful in regard to playing, you know, having people scream at you, calling you all sorts of names from the stands. Emergency department, we get all sorts of people that are in a state of mind where, you know, it's can be certainly described as chaotic. There's some organization to it, but I think that aspect of things, there's certainly a personality type that I can see why they don't like it.
Right.
And why others, you know, really feel like that's their comfort zone, and I wouldn't say I'm an adrenaline junkie, but I really enjoy that setting, so maybe I am.
Gotcha. So when I first came across you, was that a KP TEDx event. I don't know if I'm getting the name exactly right. And I remember you talking about, you know, being trained as a physician and that some of the things you were coming across were not necessarily always medical kind of issues. And, you know, first of all, before we get into that, how was TEDx? Is that hard to do? Is it easy to do?
It was incredibly difficult for me to do, and not in the sense that many...
Because you don't get any notes or prompters or anything, right?
No is the short answer. And I think not only... I am fortunate. I'm not one of the majority that's terrified of public speaking. Like, I wasn't terrified of being in front of the group, but the setting, and I, you know, doing research presentations is relatively easy. I know the content, I stand up, it's the delivery is not what matters. And so, you know, that was the part that really took me out of my comfort zone. I feel like I'm not a born actor. I'm not a born on the stage person. And so memorizing a talk and memorizing a talk that meant a lot to me and trying to deliver it in a way that people would understand what I was trying to communicate. I left with an amazing respect for people who are performers, people who are actors, people who are, you know, on camera and just know how to deliver. It makes it look, when people do it well, it looks so seamless.
Skill, yeah.
And for me, it was really, really a challenge. So I enjoyed it and the process was great. So it was fun. And when I got the opportunity to do it, I was really excited because I love watching the TED Talks because I think they're amazing. So it was a great opportunity, but it was a big stretch.
Yeah. Well, you did very well. So for those folks out there that weren't there, didn't get to listen, do your TEDx for us. So tell us your story.
All right. Well, I will not do my TEDx justice, but I think the bottom line of what I tried to communicate is first, when I was first early resident in Indiana, and I went in to see patients, and frequently they were there for things that really weren't medical problems. And it kind of bothered me because I remember thinking, I went to medical school to learn about the body, learn about health, learn about medications. And when people showed up and they were like, well, I can't get that medication. I remember thinking, well, I don't know what to do about that. I'm sorry. I began to rely heavily upon the social workers and kind of these what non-medical needs. The example I use in the TED Talk, which I think summarizes, and there's a lot of these, I mean, one I could use from here in LA Medical Center is we see a chief complaint pops up on my list to go see in our emergency department, says foot pain. So I go in to see the guy with foot pain. Nice guy. His feet look terrible. He's got blisters and all sorts of kind of abrasions, and his feet are dirty because he's a homeless gentleman and he doesn't have any shoes. I mean, so his problem, it's not foot pain. His problem is he doesn't have any shoes.
Right.
And we're able to get him shoes. And so these non-medical things, they kind of bothered me, not because they're not important, but because I thought, well, the ER is not the place to find people shoes or food or, you know, help them with their health plan so that they can get the medications that they need. And then as we all, I guess, grow and experience more, we had a real tragedy and really the worst, my worst nightmare come true. I shared about our daughter. So I mentioned briefly, so I'm married to my high school sweetheart, Amy, and she's amazing. And I married up and she's put me through all levels of training. And we were crazy because we had a kid in undergrad and medical school in residency and then in fellowship.
Yeah.
So no level of training got through without us adding another member of the family. But our youngest is Scarlett, and she's five now, but she was four when this happened. Perfectly healthy kids, fortunately. And one night we were home, and she said she had a headache, and I kind of brushed it off. She happened to be eating ice cream, and I said, oh, yeah, brain freeze.
Brain freeze, right.
Yeah. And I was only half listening to her. I still remember sitting on the couch. I was checking my emails from work on my phone, and I was trying to help my older son with his homework, and she said, no, Dad, it really hurts. And then she stood up and she threw up. And as I was cleaning her up, she went pretty much unresponsive in my arms. And as we've discussed, I'm an emergency physician. I've been trained what to do with people when that happens. But this was clearly entirely different. I mean, I wasn't in the ER. I wasn't her doctor. I was her dad. And I knew something was terribly wrong immediately. And as I tried to, you know, get her to talk to me, I noticed that her pupil on the right side was significantly larger than the left, which is generally a physical manifestation of increased pressure on your brain. And so I called 911. They rushed us to the closest emergency department, and I knew what was waiting for us. So longer story, but the short version was she had a large hemorrhage in the middle of her brain. So she bled into her brain, which caused her to go from normal to headache to unresponsive.
Right.
So a neurosurgeon drilled through her skull and put a drain in that relieved the pressure. She was put on a ventilator, so she was on a breathing machine. And after that, she was stable, at least, you know, her vitals and otherwise stable. They kept her sedated due to the circumstances, but learned that she had a large brain tumor. And so we were transferred to our hospital on Sunset and had amazing care. The pediatric neurosurgeon was great. Our pediatric oncologists were great. But we lived in the hospital for a month. My wife and I just alternated because, as you might imagine, you know, leaving your five-year-old in the ICU without a parent wasn't an option for us. And so all those things that I used to think didn't really matter when it came to medicine, like the medicine was relatively simple once she was stabilized. I mean, they weren't doing anything. Nobody really knew what to do. And the things that we cared about most, like, is she going to live through this, or is she going to recover from this? Is she going to ever be able to come home? Those were the things that I think people care about. That's what we cared about. And I knew nobody had answers to that. And so it was an odd position to be in where all of a sudden I cared more about the things that were totally non-medical, like the temperature of the room.
Or right.
Was her blanket soft enough or warm enough?
Or, right.
You know, what was the food? And I shared, and this is the honest truth. One of the things I appreciated most, I remember, was a call room. It was a resident call room. I think the only reason we got it was because I happened to be a doc at that hospital, and the nurse noticed that my wife and I hadn't slept for a few days, and we got to go, and they had a little shower, so I don't think I'd showered for 3 days, and we slept because Scarlett was comfortable and we were next to her. And that just core human sleep, hygiene, bed, food, I realized was every bit as important as the medical care that we were receiving. And it was something that I'd kind of poo-pooed, I guess, from my physician perspective before. And so those were things that really began to matter, that was really an enlightening experience when it came to that. And so we've done a little bit of work in looking at our members' non-medical needs as far as research goes. And we thought they'd be high. They've been much higher than we ever expected. And so I think, you know, figuring out how, you know, we're a health system. We don't do all things. We're not a food provider. We're not, we don't make clothes. We don't, you know.
We don't have extra shoes laying around.
Yeah. Right. Housing's a big problem
in
many of these high cost areas. And so we don't necessarily have an answer to all things, but I think health's our cause and therefore that's our problem. And I think we at least need to be part of the discussion and figure out, which is, you know, what we're trying to work towards doing is figure out how to help with some of those non-medical things, which contribute every bit as much as the medical when it comes to health.
So you went from being the guy talking to the person in the bed, not being able to answer all the questions, to the person asking all the questions.
Yeah, you know, I was the annoying parent asking about, like, do you have any more chocolate pudding? And it was really amazing to me because I was like, these are the questions that would have just annoyed me as a physician. Because not because I didn't care so much as, what am I supposed to do about it? I don't know if we have chocolate pudding. That's not really what I do. And just the, you know, everything from, you know, the whole person care to obviously the sitting down and listening to the nurses that that notice things besides just their core function and things that I really, if I'm honest, patient satisfaction is not something most physicians are in love with because it sometimes puts you in a bad.
Well, they're focused on medicine. I mean, they're focused on diagnosis and getting it right. And
Yeah, we didn't go into the hotel industry for a reason. I mean, and it's not that that's not an important industry, but it's, but those things matter. And I think there's a balance. And I think that's where I guess my appreciation for some of the small things. And I mentioned, and I mean small things, I mean that very small things. And things, the social support that we received was absolutely amazing. We're lucky, our families, you know, my brother drove overnight as soon as he heard, because we didn't have anybody to even just stay at home with our kids. Like our boys that were at home when I left in an ambulance, and my wife's like, well, I can't stay home, and what do you do? And you have friends and family who come to just take care of the things, that supervision of your other kids and food. Like, we weren't in a state of mind to go to the grocery store. And so those were things that, you know, I really started to appreciate that that I've, you know, Plan B is a book that many people have mm-hmm. read and has been popular, but it is, you know, the principles in that rang true to me and still do. People just, we don't know what to do. When people came up and said, hey, how are you? I didn't know what to say. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, yeah. What do you say? You say, well, worst day of my life. I can barely wake up in the morning without crying. That's not what they're asking. They want to hear a fine and keep on walking. And so just core, simple, basic things, you know, seem to matter when tragedy strikes. And so the other part of that, I guess I would say, is things I frequently worried about just didn't matter at all. So things that I didn't think mattered
right.
became much more important. And things that I used to think were important didn't. I mean, like my kids' grades. I mean, when this all happened, like, I just didn't care at all. Like, whether or not my kid had an A or a B in their class, or
right.
whether or not they were the star pitcher on the baseball team or not, or, you know, whether or not, you know, just the things that consume our thoughts, those just didn't matter at all. And so I think really what I took away from this is not just professionally, but personally, that, you know, taking a break and looking at really what we have, because what we had was amazing. What I have
right.
is absolutely amazing. And the things that I worry about really, really aren't.
Right. So I have a couple questions, but for the folks listening, so Scarlett is now 5 and doing well.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the most important.
Yeah. The punchline of this story is part of the miracle of this year, and part of, like, to be quite honest, it requires, I'm a research scientist as part of my
right.
title. And really what happened with Scarlett, it really can't be explained by medicine. And it's part of the hard part in medicine. Sometimes people get better that shouldn't, and some people who should get better don't. And that's really hard. But Scarlett has made nothing shy of a miraculous recovery. Her diagnosis was an anaplastic ganglioglioma. I'd never heard of that, even as a physician, before she got the diagnosis. It has, if you look, just over 2-year expected life expectancy.
It's just a weird thing that happens?
It is. Kids get the non-anaplastic, the simpler version, the less aggressive form of gangliogloma is about 1%, I think, of kid, I don't know if it's kid brain tumors or kid cancers in general. And the anaplastic type is less than 1% of that 1%. So it's extremely rare. If it's in a spot where they can totally surgically resect it, because it's a solid tumor, it's not like some of the others, that like some of the leukemias or other types of tumors that will metastasize and go
elsewhere.
So you
can just basically cut it out.
Yeah, if you can, hers was so large and in the central part of her brain, such that all the pediatric neurosurgeons we spoke with, not just the great one that did her surgery, no one thought it wasn't possible to remove it without, and her to, you know, survive it. I mean, so the bottom line was, is hers was in a large spot that couldn't be entire. So they took out as much as they could and couldn't get to. They found a particular genetic mutation, that's the BRAF mutation, that had been found from melanoma in adults, an entirely different cancer. And chemo doesn't really work on Scarlett's diagnosis. Radiation doesn't really work. They're all palliative. And things like radiation would have left her blind because of the large aspect of it. And hers was right near the optic nerves. And again, it wasn't to cure. It would purely be palliative. So to choose a medical procedure that's palliative, that's going to leave you blind
right.
and not save your life, seemed for us not a, you know, and with the doctors, as we discussed with them, just wasn't a viable option. So she tried this new medication that actually targets the BRAF mutation. It's never been tested at all. They weren't even sure exactly at the time what dose to give her, because they haven't even done phase 1 trials where they find out dosing for kids. And now a year later, it's 95% gone. She's got awesome. No side effects, and nobody knows what to expect next. We don't know what tomorrow holds, but from where we were a year ago to where we are today, is she's in kindergarten. she has no neuro. I mean, she's just a normal kid, which is really remarkable given where we were. So that's the punchline.
Awesome.
She's back to dance and back to kindergarten and doing well.
So, you know, when I heard you tell this story originally, and I was just kind of like on the edge of my seat because you brought to the forefront what you know, were just starting to allude to is the fact that what's happening to all of us right now is we're getting so caught up in the dumbest of details when like look today, for example, it is a beautiful day. You know, I'm driving in this morning going, this is a really beautiful day. There's really nothing that should make this day bad. You know what I mean? And I'm looking at the people next to me in traffic and they're all stressed out and they're honking and screaming. And, you know, your message really resonated to me. And I think it might have even been part of your title, but it's really the little things. You know, like you said, being able to take a shower. Think about how many people in the world can't take a shower. And the fact that you had a car that worked, that you could drive, and a home. And, you know, I really am, you know, I think the million-dollar question is, how do we get people to understand that with out hopefully having to go through something you went through, you know, because, you know, like you said, we're just living for today and let's enjoy it, you know, and that's a tough thing to get people to understand.
Yeah, there is no question. And I don't necessarily have the answer of how to do it. But what I do know is that it's possible. I think all of us have some version of tragedy that we go through. And hopefully not all have something like happened with us where they think, you know, one of their kids is life-threatening, has a life-threatening health condition. But just like you said, what I try to do now and what my wife and I have talked about is it's really the phrase of take it a day at a time.
Right.
Never, ever was more real. We never lived that until what happened with Scarlett. And even now, when people are like, how's she doing? It's like, she's doing amazing. But if I want, I could think, she hasn't made it to 2 years yet. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And even if she makes it to 2 years, I mean, the reality is with your kids, like, even if they said 10 years, I mean, like, what, 100 years?
Still
like,
not
it's,
enough.
It's yeah. not enough.
Right.
And so the reality is like, I've even read some of these, and I think this was part of, I mean, I don't know if, you know, I believe in God. Not everyone does. I think people find purpose in life in different ways. But I read a couple books that I loved. Being Mortal was one of them by Atul Gawande. And there was another one by a guy who actually died, Paul Kalanithi, When Breath Becomes Air. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it when he was given a terminal illness and subsequently passed away. But I think now I recognize, because of what we went through with Scarlett, what that means, like that I'm a planner. Back to sports and looking forward to a goal of, hey, we're going to do X, Y, Z, and we're going to get to that. And what I've realized is like tasks and getting to the end, whatever that goal is, like it is truly not the part that brings meaning and happiness to life. And it's really, truly, here's a summary of what I mean by this. When, and you can't see this, so I try to share this without crying because of just, I think it summarizes what we're talking about. When we were able to bring Scarlett home for the first time. I remember driving up, and it was beautiful. It happened to be sunset, so the sun was setting. It was one of those beautiful red, kind of golden California skies. It was a warm night, and our kids, my three other sons, knew that we were coming home. My mother-in-law, who'd been watching the kids while we were with Scarlett, was there waiting for us, and they were just sitting on our front steps of our house and waiting for us. And when they saw us pull up, you know, they were jumping up and down and excited to see us. And we just went in and had dinner. We just had our family home. We were all going to sleep in our own beds. And we got to have dinner together as a family. And to me, like everybody, most people, we did that every night of the week before, but I didn't appreciate it. And so I was worried, you know, checking my phone or, you know, what's the score of that game? Or, you know, what paper do I have due? What grant deadline do I have due? You know, what kids have homework? What practices do we have to run to? Like, those things we just didn't care about so much. It's not that we stopped doing them. We're still doing them. But it helped us, you know, and this is what I think the way I talked about it in the TED Talk is, like, putting our priorities in line is the part that brings meaning. And whether that's personally, whether that's professionally, you know, whether that's in our relationships with our family members or friends, like that, working on those things to me is how you overcome the stress, because the stress is there. But what you do with it, that I think is up to us.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the difficult things is a lot of people I come across seem to focus on what they don't have when what they have is spectacular. And like you said, the ability to go have dinner with your family, a lot of us may take for granted, because if we're lucky enough to do it every night, it just happens. But the minute it's gone for a night or two, you're like, it really can kind of freak you out. And so I just think that's so cool, that coming home and that story. You know, another big thing that I really been focused on with wellness is, and it started by reading this book called Tribe. And, you know, the concept of, you like you said, the support that you had. So I think in your case, your tribe was really amazing and what really saved you guys. You know, we probably need to do a better job in society of connecting with some different tribes in the event that something happens and we need them.
Yeah.
You know.
That, let me say, I'm really glad you brought that up, because one of the things that was an absolute, I mean, amidst this terrible tragedy, when we look back, there were so many amazing things that happened. And back to tribe, I think the current state that we live in, politics,
it's crazy,
the everything.
Yeah.
We are probably less tolerant than ever before. At least it feels that way. And we saw the exact opposite of that. And part of it was different people go through different trials. Everybody could get behind a family whose daughter was really sick,
right,
and could die. And not everybody can really get behind everyone's, you know, trials and tribulations. And what I mean by that is like divorce. Like, you know, that can be as difficult and as hard on people's, you know, psyche as an ill child. But people don't come out of the woodwork to say
right.
how sorry they
right.
are.
That's a really good point.
About right. your divorce or about losing your job. I mean, people don't. I mean, we had literally people from around the country and our entire community. People, I literally did not know some of the people that brought meals to our house. I never met them. I met them as they came to my house
right.
and had prepared something so that we had something to eat. And that was done and set up through people in our community. And so we recognize, I mean, and I mentioned, like, even back to religion, we had people from every faith I know of sending us cards saying, we're praying for you to whatever God we believe in. And that felt so good. It didn't matter that we had the exact same beliefs, because that wasn't the point. The point was we had a tribe. We had people behind us. And even, you know, this is back to plan B. It's like, I was one of those people that was like, what can I do to help? And when I was in that position, like, there wasn't anything really that anyone could have done to help. If they'd asked, hey, Adam, do you need us to bring meals into your family? I'd have been like, no, we'll just order pizza. I don't need that.
Right.
But it was a huge, and it was more than the food. It was the fact that someone cared enough to take time out of their busy schedule to make something or buy something and bring it over to us. And even things like, we had to take literally garbage bags full of stuffed animals to the Salvation Army afterward, because people didn't know what to do. But it was a stupid stuffed animal, $5
right.
stuffed animal.
Right.
But it meant a lot to us, back to tribe. And so I guess what I learned from that, what I'm trying to emulate from that, is do something. You see somebody that you care about, like, just having a bad day, it doesn't matter what you do. Get them a water bottle. Give them give them the equivalent of a stuffed animal, which doesn't mean anything other than it shows, like, I care about you and I want you to be happy. And that was where we felt so much love and support in the worst time of our life that it was like, why didn't we recognize this without this? I mean, why? And we could have, you know, maybe not to the extent, because we met people we wouldn't even have otherwise met. But I think the tribal component is important. And in healthcare, it's invaluable. I mean, physicians, we should support each other, and, you know, instead of question each other. And with nurses, like, we should understand, you know, just being more understanding of others, I guess, is something that I'm trying to do better as a result of this experience, because I think allowed us to see the good in people. And I think that's great, because it's too often right now that's not what's represented in what we see online. Yeah.
You know, you bring up a really good point in that, you know, I think that we all know what to do when the situation is drastic, but what we don't know what to do when it's different. And maybe an individual just needs someone to talk to. And maybe they're divorced, or maybe they're not divorced yet, but it's headed that direction. You know, and I think, you know, unfortunately through electronic devices and all the things we're doing now, we've lost that just personal connection. And so I know that, you know, for us in the medical group and Kaiser Permanente, we're really trying to work on that with physicians, because now more than ever, we're just too detached from one another. And we gotta get back to those close-knit groups.
And I think, and part of what I think held me back and still is hard for me now as a physician is not having answers to some of those difficult problems, like not knowing what to say. And I found saying anything is important. It doesn't matter that people had never experienced what we were experiencing. In fact, I didn't even necessarily like, some people were like, oh, my uncle had cancer and they thought he was going to die, but he lived. And personally, I hated that.
Yeah.
I was like, that's not helpful at all. Thanks for the story. I don't know what to say about that. That has probably nothing to do with my daughter. What I recognize and appreciated is that they were just trying to help.
Yeah.
And so I guess the point is that I'm trying to learn is it's not what you say. It's the fact that you care about somebody else. And regardless of how imperfect we might communicate that, or, you know, whether it's a kind word, whether it's a kind gesture, whether it's not the simple stuff we all know about, like letting somebody in that's trying to change lanes, or, I mean, just those simple things. It's just, it takes a constant and concerted effort. And I think with our coworkers, specific to healthcare, like it's not measured, it's not coming up on anything, but it makes you makes me feel better. And when it comes to wellness, like, it doesn't even matter how others receive it. You know, they might be like, it's like giving your weird uncle a bad Christmas present, and they're like, I hate this.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, sorry you hate it. That's not it's not an appropriate response, but I gave it to you because that's my token of appreciation or love or consideration, and I think makes me feel better offering that. And I think that's part of wellness.
Now, you seem like a really nice guy, so I'm assuming you've always been nice.
You don't know me that well.
You know, nice and gracious and thoughtful, but have you found yourself doing anything different lately, like, you know, saying thank you more or writing notes, or have you incorporated any practices that, you know, really are new to you?
The one thing that comes to mind with regard to that, I'd like to say that it's more than what has happened, but the one tangible thing as a physician I've taken from this is sharing a piece of my personal experience with patients. That's not, some might not even think that that's appropriate. And I can say in my experience, it's what makes my job worthwhile. And has, I feel like, helped me connect with people, because it's hard. When I am working as an emergency physician and a patient comes in who has a terrible prognosis, and they're worried and they're concerned and they're thinking all the terrible things that were going through my mind with Scarlett, I can't necessarily answer those questions. I can't say everything's going to be okay. You're not going to die, because sometimes you are. But what I found is that saying, you know, I know what it's, I felt this and it feels terrible and I'm sorry. That to me is really helpful. And it's helpful to me because I think sometimes we feel like we failed as physicians. We're all dying. I mean, that's the part that's like, that's the part that we don't talk about in healthcare. There's one thing that's for certain, and we know all of our outcomes at the end of some period of time. And the question is how do we contribute to the quality of that life? And that's what wellness and, you know, all the work that you're doing is about. And I think as physicians and as a health system, that is where I think I'm focusing more on the quality than the quantity. And I think, I guess that's, you know, when it comes to research, we try and it's generally quantity that's easier to measure, but quality of life and feeling in control of the things that we can control and not being scared of the unknown. I mean, that, I guess that's a big part is I've taken from this is, and this is a weird part, this is the other thing that I've learned in this is bad things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Being scared that, oh, what if is going to happen is just wasted energy, because bad things are going to happen. But the reality is we can get through that and we can deal with that. And so those are the two things is I think I don't worry about if bad things are going to happen any longer. Like, is XYZ going to happen? Because I think I kind of count on it. And that sounds pessimistic. But the reality is it's comforting to me because I think that's okay. Worried about that X is going to happen. X is going to happen. But knowing that we can get through it and with the tribe and with the people we love, it is worth it. And let me share one more experience.
Sure.
About that.
Yeah.
So music, like, I'm the least musically inclined individual in the world. I can't play anything. I can't stay on tune. I like to sing, but no one around me likes
sing. We do have a lot in common then, yeah.
Yeah. The first night that we were, well, not the very first night, but the first day that we were in the hospital after this happened with Scarlett, someone, I don't know who the woman was, she volunteered in the hospital to play the harp. And the first time my three boys came in to see their sister on a ventilator with a brain drain poking out of her skull, there happened to be a woman outside the pediatric ICU that was playing the harp. What that contributed to our well-being, I can't even express.
It's amazing, yeah.
And so, you know, when it comes to things like even music or the arts in general, I think the whole stop and smell the roses principle is something that I try to do more now than I did before. But again, I think back to pattern of success, like it's a concerted effort. Like even doing this podcast is great because I think the further we go from that pediatric ICU, the more effort it takes to remember the lessons that we learned from that. And so, you know, I think whether it's music, whether it's recognizing that sitting down with your family is a blessing, whether it's, I mean, I remember thinking, I've got air conditioning in my car. How amazing. Yeah. Like I've got heat when it's cold and AC when it's hot and we have amazing food around. And anyone listening to this podcast is lucky because people who aren't lucky, they're not listening to podcasts.
Right.
They don't have all that comes with, you know, the background, the devices and the good fortune that comes with even the ability to listen to something like this. And so, you know, we all are lucky. And like you alluded to earlier, I think instead of focusing on what we don't have or what we want, it's almost too simple to just look at what we already have. And I think that there's a lot of wellness that can be had in what we are and what we have without any changes.
Yeah. And you mentioned something that I found really interesting, and because it always sounds weird to say, like, you just assume bad things are going to happen. Like, it's just life, right? And I think one of the things that I try to instill in people, and mostly being from like a fitness trainer kind of perspective, is inevitably something's going to happen. What you can do, though, is be ready for it. Take care of your body. Take care of your mind. Be happy. You know, if something bad happens, you don't want to be in a bad place to begin with when that happens. But, you know, be in a grateful place with a happy heart. That will at least make the journey that's coming, the difficult journey coming up, a little bit easier.
Yeah. I think there is no question. I mean, speaking of fitness,
I bring everything back to fitness. Well, that's what I do.
It's part of wellness, and it's an important part. And I'm speaking to research. It's like when people are like, what can I do? I'm like, well, you could exercise. Like, we could all. Like, there's one happy pill that we know makes everything better and decreases your risk of all the bad stuff, and it's exercise. And I think back to your point of be prepared. You know, when we were living in the ICU, I wasn't exercising. I don't know that most normal humans would have.
Right.
But that being said, my brother just, you know, the year prior to that had talked me into running a marathon. And so the training and preparation that we had leading up to that was it's all part of that. It's all, I mean, in terms of controlling what we can do, like we have control of what we eat. You can eat things that you like, just, you know, be smart about it.
Right.
And back to fitness. I mean, I think it sounds almost Pollyanna, but the reality is if we want to be happy, we need not look outside of who and where we are. And that's the oddest thing that I can say about my experience with Scarlett, is as terrible and emotionally and mentally and physically and spiritually draining as it was, I can say with all sincerity, I've never felt greater love and appreciation for my wife, and my kids, and the people that surround me than during that time period. And I think if that's to me a core component of wellness. And so even amidst the worst possible tragedy, I think there's a way to find peace and there's a way to find wellness even when the tragic strikes. And I think that's the hope, is instead of fearing that bad's going to happen, it's like, just plan on it and go on, you know, hit it head on no matter what's coming, because it doesn't really matter. You can deal with it. You can find wellness even in the worst scenario.
Yeah, so I do have to tell you, after I heard your talk, I went home, and the first thing I did when I got home was I hugged my boys. They're 13 and 15, so they're not really in the hugging age anymore.
They might not hug you back.
They're kind of like, what's wrong with dad? But the minute I did it, and they were kind of like, what's going on? And I let go, I just kind of, all is well again, you know? And I think, you know, getting back to that title, it's the little things. And, you know, we're just not doing enough of those little things. But,
yeah.
So are you still playing basketball?
Good question. So I have officially retired from playing basketball. I'll go shoot with my kids and stuff, but interestingly, none of them are well, maybe it's not too interesting. They're not into basketball, so they're into mostly running baseball, and my eight-year-old thinks he wants to be into football too. So so we spend a lot of active time outside and a lot of time at a lot of athletic events, but basketball isn't one of them at the moment. So I still love it, but don't, from a different perspective, I've enjoyed coaching it now more than playing.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. That, you know, having been, you know, going through what you went through and being stuck in the hospital, and you know, there's probably times where you just really couldn't have left your daughter's side, but had you been able to sneak out for a run, would you have felt guilty, or do you think it would have helped?
It's a great question. And I think I didn't do it. I mean, that's the honest answer. And I think it would have helped immensely. So today, Fridays. So I have a great friend that's a perfect example of this. Back to not knowing what to do. He's the guy that showed up with not knowing what to bring. He brought us this giant comforter while we were in the hospital. And I was like,
right.
And then that night, as I'm laying on the couch bed that we have next to my daughter's bed, like, I'm like, this comforter is amazing. But his thing was like, you got to exercise. He told me, he's like, and so ever since then, we go do the 6-mile loop around the Rose Bowl twice. And it is invaluable. Part of it is I'm with a friend, but the other part is just, you know, the exercise component. So I think, yes, absolutely. Had I taken that, I mean, that was something that was just bad on me. And I think Scarlett was fine. I mean, it wasn't like,
right.
It wasn't like I couldn't leave for an hour and go work out. And I think, so I didn't necessarily do it in the few weeks we were in the hospital, but shortly thereafter is where I did start to get back into, you know, my typical exercise routine and found it amazingly helpful to just my, not just my physical well-being, but my mental as well.
Yeah, and you know, anecdotally, I had this really interesting experience a while back. My wife's dad passed away unexpectedly. He was in an accident, and you know, I'm trying to console her, and she's kind of hyperventilating a little bit, and you know, me not really knowing what to do. And I did probably the weirdest thing that's going to sound really bad, but I'm like, hey, honey, let's go for a run. And we went out in the neighborhood and went for a run, and it released her. It calmed her. And we got back and we were able to just sit down and talk, whereas before we couldn't, because she was just having this massive anxiety. And so I really, in just the kind of the weirdest, most difficult situation, saw the power of, you know, not really knowing what to do, but being outside and letting her breathe some air and see people walking their dogs. And it just released it. And I'm not saying that it'll work for everybody and it's not appropriate in all situations, but I saw the power of it firsthand, and it was strong.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think back to the little things, I think it's the stuff you can control. You can't control that tragically your father could pass away, which is horrendous. And we should still work tirelessly to try and, you know, avoid those kinds of things when they're at all avoidable. But the reality is back to bad things are going to happen. And the question is, yeah, you know, have you figured out how to cope? And part of that is the physical component of this, and taking care of your body and exercising is no question part of that overall package in terms of identifying the little things, and whether it's running, swimming, walking, getting outside, whatever it is that you're able to do, there's no question that's something we all can do. And I think contributes to the emotional healing, when we don't think of exercise as an emotional healer, but I found that it was.
Great. Well, we are kind of headed towards the end of our time here. I have a feeling you're going to be back sometime telling us about some research you're doing. So I don't think this is going to be the end of this conversation by any means, but I just got to say, you know, it was really great to meet you and hear your TED Talk, and thank you for sharing. I mean, I know that's not easy, but, you know, please know that it is helping a lot of us deal with a lot of different things. And, you know, I know it's not always hard, and that's probably one of the weird things you're going to go through is people are like, hey, tell me your story. And, you know, it's probably other things you'd like to talk about, but do know that it is powerful and it is helping. And on top of that, thank you for being a doctor and for helping people and for helping all of us take care of ourselves. And we appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, folks. Mr. Adam Sharp, thank you so much. We will see you next time.